Good morning, everyone. Chairman Friedkin has asked that we go ahead without him. He'll be here in a few minutes. I'd like to call the Wednesday work session to order on August 21, 2013 at 9:10 a.m. Before we proceed with our business, Mr. Smith has his obligatory statement to make.
Let me make my obligatory statement, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to show you how efficient Ms. Bright is, the next bullet point here says, thank you, Mr. Smith.
We don't leave anything to chance, Mr. Chairman.
Assuming he did it right.
I do want to note for each of the commissioners that at least I had, and I think each of you have a letter from the Permian Basin Petroleum Association that you might want to stick in your pocket, take a look at it. I assume it may have to do with the lesser prairie chicken. All right, the first order of business is the approval of the minutes from our previous work session that was on May 22, 2013, which have been previously distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Motion by Commissioner Scott, second by Commissioner Jones, second by Commissioner Scott. All in favor?
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. Okay. I do want to say that work session item 10, which is the potential reintroduction of the black-footed ferret, and item 13, which is a potential land acquisition for the Yoakum Dunes Preserve, have both been withdrawn from the agenda, and the Yoakum Dunes item is being withdrawn from the Thursday agenda. So our first item will be an update on the progress in implementing our land and water resources conservation and recreation plan. Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Carter Smith, and thanks for the opportunity to share a few words today on some updates related to the land and water plan. First and foremost, I'm going to pass out a handout for all of you, and so let me pass it your way, Commissioner. I think all of you remember back in one of our recent meetings, there was a discussion about the need to renew various easements and agreements going across various parks and wildlife properties. And at that time, the commission had delegated authority to the executive director to enter into those renewal agreements, provided, however, that we came back to the commission and gave them a heads up about which ones were kind of in the queue and ones that our staff were going to be looking at. And so our land conservation team prepared a spreadsheet for you of ones that are about to be negotiated. And so just wanted to invite any of you, if there's any that you have a particular interest in, if you'll just let us know and we can get you the details on that. The second thing that I want to talk a little bit about this morning, obviously the 83rd legislative session concluded their business. With that came a number of bills that were passed that have impacts to the agency and specifically to rule changes that need to be made. A number of those are fairly nominal in terms of just cross-referencing things, making sure that we've got the appropriate statutes referenced, et cetera. And so we're going to be asking for your permission to publish these proposed changes and then come back to you with those in November. This is just kind of a very short summary of what some of these are. HB 115, ID numbers on boat vessels, essentially allowing us to be able to move up the placement of the state ID number to the front of the boats. HB 597, boater education invasive species, basically codifies what our angler education team is already doing, but basically requires us to have information about invasive species in our boater education program. And so again, something that Tim Spice and others have been working on, but just puts it in statute. HB 1718, terminally ill individuals purchasing resident hunting license. This was a great initiative that was launched by the Exotic Wildlife Association. And, you know, oftentimes groups will bring in terminally ill kids from out of state to have hunting opportunities in Texas. But by law, they're required to buy a non-resident license. And so this bill would grant to the department authority to be able to change the definition of resident to accommodate terminally ill individuals from out of state so that they could acquire a resident license at a considerable cheaper fee. And so really, really pleased to see that one come to fruition.
Before you go to the next one, does that bill also have any clearance for the hunter ed requirement too? Or
I don't believe it does. Yeah, I don't believe it does.
Do we need to do anything in that regard so in the spirit of this bill to?
Most of these are going to be kids, and so if they're accompanied by somebody who has the hunter ed certification or was grandfathered in, I think they're going to be fine. And that's usually how those hunts transpire. So I think we'll be okay on that. Right. Yeah, thanks. Good question.
Do we have reciprocity with other states?
On hunter ed?
Same thing? No. Similarly, if our kids want to go hunt in their states,
it depends upon the individual state. And so this bill just applies to individuals from out of state that want to come to Texas to do this. But there's not a reciprocity agreement that was contemplated in that legislation.
Okay, but do we have an overall reciprocity agreement with other states of honoring hunting licenses or back in the movie?
Not hunting licenses. No, you've got
to
buy.
It has to be specific to
that state.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yep. Yeah, but we do have a reciprocity agreement on, again, hunter ed. You're certified in Texas, then you can hunt in New Mexico, Colorado, Connecticut, et cetera, so, and vice versa.
Okay. I think Bill's raised a good point. This new bill, is there a similar statute in effect in any other state that we're?
That's a good question, Andy. I guess we don't. Could we look that up for you and get you information
I think
on?
It's a great idea. Maybe we ought to at least alert other states that we've done it.
Yeah, it might be.
That's your point. Yeah.
We take this bill and say, look what we've done.
Yep.
And maybe not every state, but if there are states where we get more kids.
Yep.
From others, for instance, we might get a bunch of kids from Louisiana.
Right.
Well, we might want to make arrangements with Louisiana to say, hey, can you guys do the same thing for our kids?
Yeah, yeah.
We want to go hunt gators.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Gators or crawfish. We'll send them over there. I think it's a great idea, and it really is a wonderful program. It means you can imagine how much this family that gets invited to come in. I mean, it's just some of the most poignant experiences that you can possibly have. So let us find out what states, if any, have this already. And then I think it's a great idea for, you know, that may be something that the National Congressional Sportsman's Caucus works on and encourages states to adopt something like this. So, great piece of legislation. Next one, and again, I'm just kind of skipping around, hitting a couple of them, but I think this one is an important one of interest to the commission, HB 2649 and SB 1432. This basically has to do with individuals that have had an administrative violation of our trap, transport, and transplant rules. By law, that has been a Class B offense, and so this will move it to a Class C. And so, again, I think that's a good fix on that one. A Class B is a pretty serious offense, so I think make it more in keeping.
It's reducing with this.
Reducing it to a Class C. Yep, absolutely. So essentially on those suite of bills, we're just asking for your permission to go forward and publish the necessary rule changes and then come back to you in November. SB 820, sometimes called kind of the omnibus deer bill during the session, one of the things that it gave authority to the commission to do was to publish a set of rules to allow for deer breeders to have multi-year permits. Right now, by practice, our permits for deer breeders are limited to a year. This would allow those deer breeders, subject to rules set by the commission, to be able to apply for and receive permits for up to 3 to 5 years, again, subject to the conditions that you set. A couple of requirements that came with the legislation. One, a breeder needs to have had a permit for the last 3 years, so that's a eligibility criteria. And then secondly, has to be willing to complete and submit all of their appropriate reporting forms online. And, you know, that's something we've worked very closely with the breeder community on over the last couple of years to really try to transition more of that reporting to online. I think that's helped with administrative efficiency. Our permits team, I think, have really appreciated that. So there's been a big push in that community for it, and so it's been a big help. In addition, the bill requires the commission to adopt procedures relating to how the department refuses to either issue or renew a permit. And so it takes a lot of what we already do in practice in terms of an appeal process inside the agency. And we're going to be working with the breeder user group to come up with a slate of proposed rules for y'all to consider on that. Again, for individuals who feel like maybe a decision was made that they disagree with and they want to be able to have recourse to come back and appeal that. So we'll bring that back to you. In addition, we'll be coming back with some proposed rules regarding situations in which we have a deer or deer in pens that are of unknown origin, and we're concerned about disease threat of those deer because we don't know where they're from. And so this would essentially allow those individuals who find themselves in that situation to be able to go through a genetic testing of those deer to prove origin before the department takes any further action. So, again, we'll be working with Wildlife Division, Breeder User Group, to get some feedback from the community on that and come back to some proposed rules for you in November. So in that regard, we are seeking permission to go ahead proactively publish changes to the deer breeder regs and the Texas Register as required by SB 820 with an intention to seek adoption during the November 2013 commission meeting. Clearly, we have some work to do with the breeder user group to make sure that we kind of get those in order before we come to you. So anybody wants any further information on that, just let me know when we talk more about it. Also, just want to share a few words about the early migratory bird season. And I want to take a minute here and let us kind of celebrate the work of our waterfowl biologists. As y'all know, in May, this commission gave approval for the department conditionally to go forward with an early season, season and bag limit framework, subject to the service approval, and then subject to the concurrence of the chairman of the Parks and Wildlife Commission. But a couple of things that our waterfowl biologist really worked hard on with the service with respect to some migratory bird changes. First, during terial season, bag limit's going to change from 4 to 6 birds. And so we think that's a great opportunity for our hunters out there. And probably even much bigger, the possession limit for all migratory birds is now increasing to 3 times the daily bag limit as opposed to 2 times the daily bag limit. And so that's an extraordinary thing from a hunter opportunity. Hunters that go out for a long 3-day weekend now have a chance to hunt all 3 days and get their limits and be in compliance. And so significant change, and I just, again, want to compliment our wildlife biologists that worked on that. I think it's a wonderful thing for Texas hunters. So I wanted y'all to be aware of that. Quick internal affairs update. Major Carter and his team continue to do an outstanding job in that regard. I'm pleased to announce that Assistant Chief of Internal Affairs Jonathan Gray was hired. Very competitive process. I think all of you know Jonathan is a very competent, conscientious officer. Been with us for about 20 years. Had been our captain leading up our environmental crimes unit, had a lot of interaction with this this commission, but we're awfully proud to have him in that assistant chief position. And so I think commission will enjoy having a chance to work with Jonathan and Joe in that that capacity. In addition, we added a new captain investigator position inside internal affairs to build out that team a little bit, so added a fourth officer position in that regard. We've made that open where an individual who's selected for that could live anywhere around the state as long as they are attached to some field office, recognizing that those officers are on the road a lot and they don't have to necessarily live in Austin. And that opened it up considerably. I think we've had maybe as many as 40 applicants for that captain investigator job. Again, some highly, highly qualified individuals. And we hope to have a decision on that sometime at the end of this month or the first of September. So we'll keep you all posted on that from an internal affairs perspective. Red snapper. That's been a species on the minds of this commission quite a bit. Obviously, this commission authorized the agency to go forward with a lawsuit down in Brownsville, which we can proudly announce that the commission prevailed in that regard against the National Marine Fisheries Service. And so could not have been more pleased with that outcome. Hopefully you had a chance to read Judge Hannon's ruling on that. It was unambiguous. And so very, very pleased about that. NOAA has, I believe, filed a notice of intent to appeal that ruling. I don't think a whole lot has been done since then, but I did want to at least let you know about that. Next week, the Gulf of Mexico Council will be in San Antonio, so we'll have a chance to host that council in San Antonio. One of the things they'll be contemplating is the possibility for an additional offshore recreational red snapper season in October, and so we may get a few days in October for Texas fishermen to be able to fish out past the territorial seas. That'll depend upon the stock assessment and what the total assessment of the catch was during the June 28-day season. So stay tuned on that. We may have a few more days out in October. We think that'd be great. Last but not least, certainly pursuant to the direction of this commission, we've been working with the Gulf of Mexico Council and our partner states to look at models by which the recreational fishery and the management of that would be delegated back to the five Gulf states. And so there's an Amendment 39 that the council is considering in that regard. They've held public meetings around the Texas coast. I believe there are at least two meetings, one in Galveston, one in Corpus. And so more discussions to come on that front. Nothing that's going to happen at the meeting next week. A couple issues that I think are important for the commission to be aware of as we're thinking about this. You know, while we very much support that in concept and think that having the commission the authority to be able to manage the red snapper holistically in Gulf waters and in the Texas territorial seas to look at opportunity and being able to maximize that for the anglers and still facilitate the continued recovery of the stock. There still are some things that we want to make sure that we have nailed down. One, you know, what's Texas's proportion of that catch share going to be? And so obviously that's important. Secondly, we want to make sure that whatever standards for monitoring stocks that we have to do aren't any more stringent than what National Marine Fisheries Service has already been doing. And then thirdly, we want to make sure that the commission has flexibility, again, to look across the territorial seas and the Gulf waters and look at that holistically and have as much flexibility in setting seasons and bag limits to account for opportunity. Also, we just want to make sure that, you know, if, for instance, we happen to go over our allowable catch, that there's not a draconian a penalty to the states and that we have an ability to offset that perhaps in the next year. So some pretty commonsensical things you'd think with respect to managing those stocks. And so Robin and I will keep you posted on that front. But we all appreciate the commission's very strong engagement on this. It's been a topic, obviously, of considerable interest to the department, and I feel like we're making headway on the direction that y'all have given us.
Before you leave that topic, did Florida move forward as anticipated on their snapper season?
So, yes, they did. They did move forward on that, and we're still in the throes of the discussion with them on the Gulf Council and how we'd manage kind of the state management of that. And so some issues that we have there with Florida that we still need to work out, to be candid with you.
Well, I know we've said it once, but that was an incredible job by the legal staff and the Attorney General's office to pull that off, because that wasn't easy. And there's an old saying that nobody likes lawyers except their own.
And let me, when they win.
Especially when they win. But they did a good job and did the citizens of Texas a good service, so we appreciate that.
Well, as a lawyer, I knew you weren't going to give the Shakespeare quote so. No. That's great. And Commissioner, thank you for your words of support to our team and the Attorney General's. I really appreciated that. So thank y'all. This year, the Department of Justice entered into a settlement with BP with respect to criminal settlement as a function of the damages from the Deepwater Horizon spill. As part of that settlement that BP had with the Department of Justice, they agreed to a $2.3 billion fine that would go to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to compensate for those damages from the spill, and that's kind of one element of the whole BP thing. Again, these are just the criminal penalties. As part of that settlement with the Department of Justice, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is required to do a couple of things. One, there's a stratification as to how that $2.3 billion in funds would be distributed throughout the states. Texas's share of that is $203 million. It'll be coming over a five-year time period with half of those funds coming in years four and five. So we'll get half the funds in years one, two, and three, and then the other half will come in years four and five. And when I say we get them, let me clarify that. All those funds reside with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. But according to the settlement with the Department of Justice, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is obligated to use those funds exclusively for the restoration, enhancement, and conservation of specific natural resources that were harmed by the spill. It doesn't have to be in the specific geography of the spill, but if there were marshes that were impacted somewhere, which obviously there were, and we wanted to do marsh-related restoration in Texas, you know, that would be an allowable expenditure of those funds because essentially it's a like kind of habitat resource that we would be helping to enhance and restore and benefit the entirety of the Gulf. The other part of this settlement with the Department of Justice is that they are required to coordinate and consult and essentially have the states nominate and recommend projects to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. And so in Texas, those three agencies are the General Land Office, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, and the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And so the three executive directors of those agencies essentially will serve as kind of an executive council for reviewing projects that are nominated for those funds. We'll review them and score them based on some kind of an appropriate criteria. Then we'll coordinate with the governor's office to make sure that they are okay with the expenditure of those funds, and then we'll then nominate those to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, who makes the ultimate decision on that. So we've just started this process. It's really brand new. They asked us to recommend kind of a series of pilot projects this summer that we have done as part of the broader Deepwater Horizon process that we've been going through with the natural resource damage assessment. You know, we've had well over 200 coastal projects that have been nominated for consideration as part of that. So we essentially use that as our universe of projects to look through. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation also said that for this first tranche, they really wanted us to look at projects primarily in the upper coast, primarily kind of the Galveston Bay area, which, you know, was one of those areas in Texas that was harmed from the spill. And so we've recommended a variety of projects, an oyster reef restoration project, a dune restoration project there on Bolivar, marsh restoration project, a land conservation project on the backside of Galveston Island. And then there's a partnership with Ducks Unlimited for restoring and enhancing wetlands on private lands in the mid and upper coast. And so those were the five projects that we submitted, the three agencies to the foundation. They met with their board last week or the week before to talk about those. And I think they're going to have a few questions for us. And then those will ultimately be taken in September for consideration. As we go forward in this process, you know, the agency is contemplating a number of fairly significant projects that, you know, we would like to have considered along with all of our other partners. And so, you know, something maybe even as early as the November commission meeting, you know, we may want to come back and probably should to talk about various potential land conservation projects and others. There's a fairly significant project down on the Mid-Coast that we are looking at in partnership with several agencies. And so I think it would be good if we scheduled a briefing with the commission that kind of dealt more specifically with some significant projects that we're looking at, and made sure the commission was comfortable with us before we proceeded further. And so I wanted to give that kind of high-level update and see if you had any questions about that.
Dick.
Yeah, Carter, there's some that you know that I know about that we've discussed, and I'm just curious, what is the, or perhaps I'd like to see what the criteria list is. How do we get from A to B when it comes to it? And I don't know, I'm sure the rest of the commissioners here would kind of like to have a understanding of how these are rated and,
yep,
you know, the, just for general information,
yep,
so we can kind of figure out. And then also when you weight them, you know, I can't see why we wouldn't have a preference if there's other monies involved that are getting kicked into them. I'd just be curious to see how y'all's rating deal between,
yep,
y'all, TCEQ, and, you know, just
GLO.
So I'll understand, so we can understand, you know, what they're using as a criteria.
Yeah, it's a great question. And so that criteria has not yet been developed. So literally as soon as this got launched, the foundation asked us to kind of look at the universe of projects that were already out there, pick a couple as pilot projects in a specific geography. So they gave us kind of a, you know, look at projects that are what they would call no-brainers initially, and so that's these first five that we submitted. And I think, Robin, those account for about $9 million. Am I correct on that, $9.2 million, something like that? And so one of the things we will be doing over the next couple of months is developing those criteria. And so, you know, issues like leverage, being able to match funds, those kind of things undoubtedly will be part of that scoring system. And so we can come back and talk to the commission about that and let y'all take a look at that.
Mr. Chairman, not to belabor probably an obvious point, but one of the things you obviously want to look at is this money will run out in 5 years, I assume. Is that correct, or is it going to go on? Is it supposed to be replenished?
No, this is a
years?
Yeah, good question, Commissioner. No, this is a finite 5-year time frame, $203 million tranche. There will be other dollars that will come to the state to be able to apply it as an artifact of various settlement processes with BP. There's kind of three pots of funding. One will come through the natural resource damage assessment process. One is through this National Fish and Wildlife Foundation process, and a third one is the Restore Act. And so when we come back in November, I think we'll give a more detailed update of each of those three. So there will be additional funding coming, but from different pots of or different sources.
Okay. Well, and my point will be the same. Whatever projects you consider funding, it needs to be geared toward one-shot,
yep,
hits rather than ongoing obligations that the state might have to,
yeah,
fund into the years if you want to keep it going. In other words, I'd just be sensitive to really more infrastructure-type,
yep,
things that,
yep,
where you need funding to get it going, and then it'll take care of itself from that point on, because otherwise you can get yourself into buying a Rolls Royce that you now have to get the oil change.
Yeah. If only it were that easy. I think it's a great point, Commissioner. And one of the things interesting with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, they're very cognizant of that. And so, you know, we've had discussions, you know, for instance, on potential land acquisitions for state parks or wildlife management areas is the possibility of requesting endowment funds to help offset, you know, those restoration enhancement costs and those kind of things. And so those are definitely discussions we'll have. I think that a lot of these are going to be exactly what you're talking about. They're one-time, finite. It's a marsh restoration project. It's a dune restoration project. It's a wetland restoration project. It's a native prairie restoration project, et cetera. But you're right. The idea of making sure everybody is aware of, are there any recurring costs or any downstream costs that we need to be mindful of is a very, very good one.
One last question.
Mm-hmm.
Is the I know the criteria hadn't been established yet. You're still working on that. But is there a requirement that the projects, TCEQ, GLO, Texas Parks and Wildlife, agreed projects, is there a nexus requirement to the BP damage, or is that somewhat removed?
So it's a really good question. We don't use the term nexus because of the legal implications of that, and it's worded a little differently, but it, and so I'm going to have to paraphrase here and I'll get you the language, but basically the concept is, as long as the funds are being used from a conservation perspective to address an injury to a specific resource or habitat type from the spill, then it's an allowable expenditure of those funds.
Loosely tied.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's tied in type. Okay. Again, injury to a marsh, injury to a barrier island, injury to a wetland, injury to migratory birds, but it's not necessarily tied to geography of impact.
Got it.
That might. Okay. Is that okay? Okay. Good question.
So you are going to come back in November?
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
I think so, Commissioner. Just given all the issues with this, a lot of our partners are, you know, keenly interested in these funding sources and how to be able to access them and apply for grants to help, you know, achieve conservation goals, which, you know, unquestionably help advance those of the agency. And so we want to make sure that everybody understands again what those opportunities are, and we've just had a chance to just keep talking about this. So,
and I think you made this point, but just so everybody's clear on it, the first year the funds are pretty limited, aren't they? About $10 or $12 million for available funds, at least out of the NIFWIP.
Yeah, the first year allocation to Texas was $12.3 million. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation asked us to submit projects, really preferentially, that didn't exceed $9 million. They just, for whatever reason, that was kind of the number they picked. They wanted to kind of run through some projects through their system. And, you know, National Fish and Wildlife Foundation has been around for a long time. They were created by Congress, and they administer a bunch of grant programs, many of which that this agency has benefited from over time. But as you might imagine, one day having your balance sheet bump up by $2.3 billion and then be required to administer that, you know, they're wanting to kind of take that slowly and make sure that they have their processes and systems in place to be able to administer and effectively dispense those grants. And so they didn't want us going too quickly on that. And so that was true with all the states.
Carter, is the $2.3 billion already been paid by BP, or is it being paid over 5 years also?
It's being paid over 5 years.
Okay.
Yep.
So
yep.
They don't have a lump sum of money right now?
No. It's a 5-year commitment. Again, court decree with the Department of Justice required to have annual monitoring, et cetera, by DOJ. Half of those funds will come in year 4 and 5. And so in November, we'll lay out that schedule for you as to what's expected in year 2, 3, 4, and 5. So, okay. More questions on that, Mr.? Okay. All right. I want to give you an update on where we are with the license sale system. As a reminder, August 15th, licenses went on sale, and so I know I can count on 9 super combos around this table. We've already accounted for that revenue-wise. But I wanted to let you know that we have notified Verizon, subject to our contract, of our 60-day planned termination of that contract. What that means is on October 19th at around 9 o'clock, we will make the formal transition to the new license sale provider, Gordon Darby. I think we'll have a couple of hours of blackout time there after 9 p.m. on the 19th, where the system will be downed as just we go through backups and redundancy stuff and various validation stuff. So we'll certainly make sure that we get information out there. But our team has been working very, very diligently on the user acceptance testing, bringing in point of sale related agents and vendors to come and test the system, and I really feel confident that we're ready for rollout. And so again, really proud of our IT team and IT team and AR team as to how they have managed this. And Gordon Darby has really been great to work with. They picked this October 19th time frame. As y'all recall, last time we talked about this, we were going to be making a decision as to whether or not we went ahead and terminated that contract this summer, and so we were ready for the Gordon-Darby system to go into effect for the August 15th opening of the sale system. And ultimately, we decided we just probably weren't there, and so we just pushed that back a bit, and if again, picked this October 19th date. But we're there now. We've notified Verizon of the planned termination, so it's happening. So stay tuned on that, and if you want to watch the press accounts, exactly.
The 19th is a Saturday too, which is a good seems like a good day of the week to at night to do that.
Yeah.
All right, Dick, you'd be busy about that.
Right. We'll have a team scouring the Walmarts and academies around the state. Any commissioners want to join us that Saturday night late? I want to invite everybody to do so. It's with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude and see if any of the commissioners have any questions.
Anybody have any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The second item is a financial overview. I think Justin Halverson is going to present this. Welcome, Justin.
Good morning, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Justin Halverson. I'm the team lead at the AR budget section. And today, I will be presenting the 2014 financial overview. There are six topics that I'm going to be discussing today. The first one is I'm going to walk you through the process of how we get from the General Appropriations Act to the total budget that we will be asking your approval on. The second is I'm going to summarize the operating and capital budgets. This includes the budgets by division. Third, I'm going to update you on the capital and conservation account, known as account 5004. I need to update you on the impact of some recent legislation. Fourth, I'm going to talk about the FTEs, and I'm going to wrap it up by talking about the budget and investment policy and the state parks list for performance measures. Now, before I go into the specifics of 2014, I think it's really important to briefly recap this past legislative session. By all measures, it was very successful. We went into the legislative session in January with a base request of $507 million over the biennium. We also had six exceptional items with a total of $103 million.
Thank you.
That base was approved, and every one of those six exceptional items was approved, at least in part, for a total of $78 million. We also had additional funding that paid for employee salary increases, $5 million for a helicopter for law enforcement, $2 million is a pass-through to A&M for quail research, and $700,000 for construction at Big Spring and Fort Boggy. Finally, House Bill 1025 was supplemental funding for FY 2013. That includes funding for the Bastrop recovery, parks construction, Cedar Bayou restoration, and the backfill of state parks contingent revenue. So let's get into the specifics of FY 2014. TPWD's bill pattern in the General Appropriations Act is Article 6, which is the natural resources, and we received $323.7 million. Article 9 of the Appropriations Act, also known as General Provisions, was added $14.2 million. That includes $11 million for new bond funding as well as the salary increase. Within that GAA figure, there are federal funds of approximately $38.5 million. We added an additional $150,000, and most of that is related to a NOAA grant segment specifically related to shellfish. Additionally, within the GAA, we have about $4.9 million of appropriated receipts. We added about $740,000 of additional funding. This is primarily contractual agreements, examples of which include the natural resources damage assessment for about $250,000, agreements that we have with local municipalities for rainbow trout stocking, that's about $170,000, and an agreement that we have for Wilder tram access to service some communication towers on the Franklin Mountains, that's about $60,000. Once we add in the fringe benefits and the BRP, you get to the total budget of $379.89 million. Now let's go ahead and take a look at this by method of finance or fund. Starting with account 64, you can see that it's $41.32 million, moving counterclockwise. Fund 9 is $127 million. Federal funds of $44 million. That's primarily consists of five federal grants, Sportfish, $18 million, wildlife restoration of about $16 million, boating safety of $3.5 million, trail grants of $3 million, and SWIG of $2.5 million. The other funds of $6.73 million primarily consist of appropriated receipts and contracts, plus the license plate accounts. General revenue of $101 million, about 70% of that is in sporting goods sales tax. The GRD other of $1.5 million, that's about a half million in the lifetime license account and about a million in the operators and chauffeurs account, which law enforcement uses for border security. Finally, the GEO bonds of $56.82 million. Now, I do want to point out that this slide includes the fringe benefits and the BRP that I mentioned before. I'd said that the federal funds built into the GAA were about $38.5 million. The difference that you see here in the $44.3 million consists of those employee fringe benefits. These next two slides are going to look at the division budget summaries. And again, the summaries that you see by division are operating, capital, and fringe benefits.
Is there anything that's not in there? Operating, capital, and fringe, is there anything that's not in here?
No, sir. It's all included in there. All right, we're going to start with AR at $8.45 million. There's about $100,000 that was tied to exceptional item funding there. Coastal fisheries at $17.23 million, approximately $1 million of exceptional item funding. Communications at $8.45 million. They received $64,000 in exceptional item funding. Department-wide at just over $20 million. There's an individual slide on DY, so I'll get to the details on that later. Executive, $3.27 million, about $66,000 of exceptional item funding there. Human resources at just over $2 million. They also received $66,000 in exceptional item funding. IT, $7.3 million. That's $100,000 of exceptional item funding. Infrastructure at $6.4 million. They also received about $100,000 in exceptional item funding. Inland fisheries, $20.64. They received $1.6 million of exceptional item funding. In law enforcement, $67.79 million. They received $1.3 million in exceptional item funding, plus the $5 million for the helicopter. Moving on, legal at just over $1 million. They got $26,000 in exceptional item funding. Local parks at 14.32. They received $7.7 million in exceptional item funding that was tied to the pass-through to the community parks. State parks at 90.87 million. They received 8.2 million of exceptional item funding. Wildlife at 31.74 million. They received 3.8 million of exceptional item funding. Capital construction at 63.42. They received 15 million of exceptional item funding, plus the $500,000 for Fort Boggy and the $200,000 for Big Spring that I mentioned. Capital information technology at 5.37, they received about $1 million in exceptional item funding. And finally, the general land office transfer of $11.23 million. GLO did not receive any kind of exceptional item.
Justin.
Yes, sir.
Justin, I got a couple two quick questions.
Yep.
Start at the bottom on that GLO transfer. What is
yes,
that? What is that made up of?
As far as like what is it?
Yeah, what? Yeah.
It's a pass through that we have to make to the general land office. By all accounts, it's money that the general land office should get directly, but it's actually in our bill pattern. We have to turn right around and give it to GLO. They use it for coastal erosion.
Coastal erosion.
Yes, sir.
So how? I thought that's where I'm headed with this question. Since we got that new ruling from the Supreme Court, about how you've got that area between high tide mm-hmm. and the other one, you know, where it really kind of tattooed landowners down on the coast.
Yep.
How does that apply now that it's not all contiguous Texas land per se, as I understand it? And I met with the commissioner, and he explained it to me extremely in detail, and much more detail probably than I've had time to grasp in an hour and a half. So I'm trying to understand how that ruling affects what we do.
Well, I think the General Land Office could probably comment on that probably better than we could. As far as as far as the budget side and as far as the finance side, we're still required to pass through that $11.23 million to them.
Carter, you understand sure. what I'm saying, and I understand
I
putting him in disadvantage, so I'm just trying to understand where that...
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great question, Commissioner. So as Justin said, these funds go for beach nourishment, and those have been grants that the General Land Office then makes to local communities around the coast to help restore sand to eroded beaches around the coast. And you're right, that Galveston case had important implications for the land office. How they are choosing to, or how they're able to then adhere to that new legal environment, we're not sure. This has just simply been a kind of a multi-session issue that we've had, in which funding has come to us and then to be passed through directly to land office. So we have no knowledge, no involvement. There's no reporting. We're just simply a pass-through entity for these funds.
So that's why I wonder what criteria is even being used.
Yeah.
You've now got that ruling that's right dead in the middle of everything.
Yep. Yeah, I don't know, Commissioner. It's a good question, and I know it's one that the GLO has been grappling with.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
My other question real quick was just under the capital construction, how much of that 63.4 is for parks?
I don't have that information right in front of me, but I can get that for you.
I'm just curious.
May I get Rich to come forward and give us at least an approximate estimate on that, Justin?
Commissioners, my name is Rich McMonagle. I'm the director of the Infrastructure Division. That number, $63.42 million, start with, most of that is the transfer of unexpended balances forward into the next biennium. So what the legislature gave us for 14 and 15 was $11 million in general obligation bonds, all but... about $4 million of that will go to state parks, to answer your question. So of that $11 million, about $7 million will go to state parks. On top of that, the number also includes $8 million for Fund 9. That will all go to the Fund 9 divisions. So
that's roughly 20 a year goes to those two. That's roughly 40. So.
Well.
Is that an accurate statement, I guess?
Let me do the math real quick. As I said, we got $11 million for next biennium, and nearly all of that will go to state parks. I'm not sure I understand your question beyond that.
Well, I was just, if you're saying 11, so you got two 11s, I guess, right?
Or is that no, 11 total.
Over the 2 years?
Correct.
Okay, then so where is the other 21 going? No, it's a lot more than that.
Yes, sir. So let me explain that again. Of that $63 million, $11 million of it is new. The other $52 million is money that is already dedicated to projects that are in the works.
And are most of those rich, or is it safe to say that most of those are in state parks? And is a big portion of that in the battleship?
Well, $25 million of it is in the battleship. To give you an idea, we have a portfolio that right now is over 100 projects spread. About 80% of that is generally in state parks.
There you go.
Well, I remember we had the five-year bond program. This is the fifth year. I mean, a certain percent of this is the fifth year of that.
So it typically takes our infrastructure team kind of, 4 to 5 years for these major capital projects. And so it's not surprising that you're seeing these funds carry over from one biennium to the next. Because remember, we have to go through the approval to be able to issue bonds. And then we got to go out for design and bid. And then we get into the construction. And so, yeah, you're basically seeing projects that are kind of in years, you know, 3, 4, and 5 of the construction process going forward. So it's going through its normal cycle. Why don't what we do of the $63 million there, we'll get you a breakdown as to exactly how those funds are allocated, so you can see that specifically. We'll have good question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Anything else before I go on? All right, let's go ahead and talk about the department-wide budget. DWIDE basically handles most of the agency's overhead expenses that can't necessarily be tied to any one division, as well as housing the agency's strategic reserve account. So I'm going to start from the top and kind of work our way down. Rider 27UB from 2013 of $5.5 million. That consists of $3 million of Fund 64 and $2.5 million of Fund 9. This is very unique because this is the first time in recent memory that we've had the ability to actually move forward general revenue dedicated funds from across the biennium from 2013 into 2014 that is not construction related. Typically, the LBB limits our UB across the biennium on GRD funds to something that's specifically tied to construction. Next, we have payments to license agents at $3.67 million. Those are to the agents such as Walmart and Academy who sell our licenses. Debt service at $3.45 million. Now, this debt service is specifically related to the 98 through 2001 bond issuances. Any of our more recent bond series are paid directly from TPFA. So you don't see it anywhere in our bill pattern. It's in TPFA's bill pattern. License system, which Carter just mentioned, is going to be both Verizon and Gordon Darby, is $3.12 million. Uncertified authority, I'm going to skip that for now and come back to it. The strategic reserve account, which the Rider 27UB is actually going to move into that strategic reserve account. Right now it's sitting at $1.24 million. SORM is the State Office of Risk Management. That's the workers' compensation assessment. That's about $800,000. Airport Commerce is a building that we have just east of here. That's $680,000. Utilities, $330,000. And the pass-through plates, which are the plates related to our nonprofit partners, Big Bend Lions Camp, Marine Mammal, and Marine Conservation, for a total of about $100,000. Finally, we get to the master lease payment of about $70,000. All right, now going back to the uncertified authority, that contains two specific items. The first one is related to Rider 23, which is the motor vehicle donation. As you know from my last presentation, there's a $5 opt-in whenever you register your motor vehicle. The estimate that we have in 2014 and 2015 is $592,000 per year. We feel that that's a little bit aggressive, at least to start out the year. So what we've done is within the state parks budget, $500,000 is tied to that rider, and we've held $92,000 back in department-wide. Now, if we end up bringing in over that $500,000, then we'll be able to move some of that amount that's sitting in the uncertified authority to wherever Carter and the executive staff feel is necessary. The rest of that uncertified authority, about $1.2 million, is related to the sporting goods sales tax fringe. As you know, we've been struggling the last couple of years on sporting goods sales tax fringe, and we've been trying to get additional sporting goods sales tax fringe. We were successful in doing that this legislative session with House Bill 7, but when we did that, we used a multi-pronged approach to try and get that sporting goods sales tax fringe, and part of that $1.2 million that you see there is just a result of that. Now, we can't do anything with that uncertified authority, but what you need to know is that sporting goods sales tax fringe issue that we've struggled with for a couple years, we successfully got that money and it's being used exactly where it needs to be. All right, let's talk about the budget by type of expense, also known as object of expense. You can see that the salary and other personnel costs at $148.84 million, that's by far our largest group, that's about 40%. Operating at just over $81 million. That includes things such as rent, travel, pens and paper, and about $10 million worth of utilities. grants. That would include the local park grants that got restored. That also includes the $1 million of A&M Quail Research Grant that I mentioned before, as well as the $11 million for the GLO. Capital budget, that includes items such as cars and trucks and boats and the helicopter, that's $74.89 million. The debt service I mentioned before at $3.45 million, and fringe benefits at $41.18. All right, let's go ahead and talk about the capital budget. Now, before I go into the details of the slide, I don't want you to confuse this bottom line capital budget number here of $83.1 million with the $78 million that you, or the $74 million that you see on this slide. Now, the difference is that there are, within the capital budget authority that we have on this slide, there are specific items that aren't necessarily coded as capital. Let me give you a good example. In the construction and minor repair, that consists of projects that are generally under $100,000. An example of that might be to fix a roof in a bathroom at a state park or something like that. In order to do that project, they need to purchase nails and shingles and stuff like that. Those individual items, nails and shingles, are not necessarily capital in the sense of the tangible expense, but when we aggregate those together, it's considered a minor repair project. Okay, so if we look at the right on the top, the construction and major repairs, we're at that 63.42. The UB, as Rich mentioned, that's 47.72, so that's how much we're carrying, the estimate right now that we're carrying forward from 13 into 14. The new construction funding that we have, again, as Rich mentioned, the total is 15.7. That includes the $11 million in the new bond funding, plus $4 million of Fund 9 construction, plus the $500,000 and the $200,000 for Fort Boggy and Big Spring. The construction and minor repairs, I just mentioned that one. Information technology, there's about $1 million worth of exceptional item funding tied to that. Now, this is things that are related, such as PCs and IT services. Transportation items, there was about $1.8 million of that was tied to exceptional item funding, plus the $5 million helicopter that I mentioned before. Capital equipment, about $600,000 was tied to exceptional item funding. The total for that is 1.34, and finally we get to the master lease at about at $70,000. All right, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the Parks and Wildlife Capital and Conservation Account. And before I go any further, I want to make sure that we're clear. The Capital and Conservation Account doesn't actually include any capital in it. At one point in years past, it probably did. But right now, it's really just a conservation account. So don't confuse the capital that I'm talking about right now in this account with the capital I've talked about in the last couple slides. So according to TPWD code, the commission is required to approve any projects that are funded within the account 5004. Historically, this account has consisted of sporting goods sales tax and the TPWD conservation plates. And by those plates, I'm talking about the horned toad, the blue bonnet, the deer plate, and the bass plate. The sporting goods sales tax portion of this account was cut by the 82nd legislature. House Bill 7 of the 83rd legislature that we just had, they shifted those conservation plates from account 5004 into a new account called the License Plate Trust Fund. And again, there's a nomenclature issue. I don't want you to, when you see trust fund, don't think about it in terms of a legal trust entity. It's just called the License Plate Trust Fund. So when they moved, starting in 2014, all the revenue from those four conservation accounts are now going to be deposited into this License Plate Trust Fund. The existing balances that existed in the account 5004, those balances are still there, and we will be able to use them at some point. But we do not have access to those funds in 2014 and 2015.
Well, that's kind of confusing.
Yeah, explain that one if you would. Yeah. I don't follow
the money,
that.
But we don't have it.
Okay. But let me back up and give you a little bit of historical context. So in 2010 in the 2010-2011 session, then we had the ability to access not only existing revenue in those plate balances, but we could also tap into any prior balances.
Okay. That were unused.
That were unused, exactly.
Okay.
The cuts that we took starting in the 12-13 biennium, they cut off the existing balances. So they said starting in 2012, you could only use any revenue that you bring in starting in 2012.
So anything before 2012, they took?
They didn't take it. They just said you can't access it.
Can't use it.
Exactly.
I think that's the same thing.
Worse. you see it, but you can't
All right.
use it.
All right, I'm with you. It's there, but you can't use it.
Exactly. So
if you want to use it, you got to add money to it.
If you want to use it, the legislature has to tell you you could use it. They'd have to appropriate it to you as far as the existing fund balance. So we had these existing fund balances these last 2 years that we haven't been able to use.
Okay.
We have been any money that we received on September 1st, 2011, that started the 2012 appropriation year, we were able to use that. But any balances that existed as of 8/31 of 2011, we were not able to use.
Okay.
That same thing has happened now in 2014 and 2015, except for any new revenue that we receive starting in 2014, that's going to be deposited into this new license plate trust fund. Those existing balances in 5004 that basically were from 2011, those are still there. We just can't tap into them. But we can tap into them when the legislature tells us that we can tap into them.
So what happens, so it just sits there?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Used to balance the budget.
Is that
our budget or their budget?
Their budget.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's what I thought of.
Understood.
At one time, that was also true for the lifetime licenses money. Is that still true, or do we have access to that money now?
Well, right now on the lifetime license, we use just the interest. We don't use the principal on that.
We just use the interest.
Yes, sir. That's correct. That's right.
And it's still the same circumstances. We need to have permission to use it, or we...
I don't believe we even have the authority to use the principal. I think we can only use the interest on that. Is that correct? Yeah, okay. All right, so I know this is a very confusing issue, so I don't want to go on to another slide until I want to make sure you guys are...
What is the fund balance?
Yeah, we're looking at about $1.3
million.
Yep. All right, are we okay? All right, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about FTEs.
Like it or not.
The FTE cap in 2013 was 3,006. For 2014, that's jumped up to 3,109.2. Now, we budget FTEs above that cap, knowing that we can manage down to the FTEs through the attrition process, through vacancies and stuff like that. So we've, starting in 2014, we're over budgeting the cap by about 1.6%. In 2013, it was about 2.8%. Typically, the agency budgets between 3 and 5% over. So we're actually very conservative this year. All right, FTEs budgeted by division. I don't have a lot really to specifically add to this, but I will mention a couple things. Coastal fisheries at 202.5. State parks at 1323.2 and wildlife at 293.8. Those divisions were the primary beneficiaries of additional FTEs that we received through the exceptional item process. Most of the other divisions were relatively flat. All right, let's move on to the budget and investment policy. There really isn't any significant changes from last year. Any budget adjustments or donations over $500, budget adjustments that are not related to federal funds or bond funds that are over $250,000 must be approved by the commission chair, the vice chair, or one of the commissioner's designees. Same thing with donations over $500. Any funds are authorized for any use permitted by statute or rule. Again, there's no change on this. All right, your Exhibit E is the investment policy. And again, there's no change on this. The Public Funds Investment Act requires an investment policy and an annual review by the governing body of a state agency depositing and investing funds outside of the Treasury. PFIA requirements are not applicable to funds deposited inside the state treasury, and currently all TPWD funds are deposited inside the state treasury. Now, the executive director will identify and appoint an investment officer in the event that any TPWD funds are ever deposited outside of the treasury. All right, the state parks listing. The commission is required at the beginning of each biennium to approve the state parks list. The department then adjusts either higher or lower during the biennium, and then those adjustments are incorporated into the next list. In 2012-13, we had 95 state parks, and now in 14-15, we also have 95 state parks. We've added to the Kronkowski and the Palo Pinto, and then we've removed to the Perry Haynes Ranch and Lake Texanum. I will go through the abbreviated version of this presentation faster tomorrow, at which time I will read this motion into the record and ask for you to take action. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Do you have any questions or comments? Okay, thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
Work session item three, our internal audit report, which Cindy Hancock will present. Cindy?
Good morning. I'm Cindy Hancock, Director of Internal Audit, and I'm here today to provide you an update on the fiscal year 13 internal audit plan and any ongoing or closed external audits. This is a summary of the internal audit projects approved for fiscal year 13. Our audit group of seven, which includes me, had a total of 43 projects to complete this fiscal year. This included 37 regular audits and 6 advisory projects. We've completed and issued reports for all 21 state park audits, all 9 law enforcement audits, the Endangered Species Section 6 grant audit, and 2 advisory projects. This totals 33 projects completed to date. These 7 projects are in progress at this time. The follow-up audit, BIS, Customer Service Center, the safety program audits are all in fieldwork stage at this time. Agency retirement payout audit, fleet safety drug and alcohol testing audit, and 1 advisory are in the reporting stage and should be issued shortly. We only have 3 advisory projects left to perform in order to complete our audit plan. These projects will be carried forward into the new fiscal year. Closed external audits this fiscal year include a host of, we've been busy. A desk review was conducted by the governor's office regarding a grant for a records management system and smartphone project. The only reportable finding was that TPWD didn't submit a procurement questionnaire in a timely manner to the Department of Criminal Justice prior to obligating grant funds. A process has been developed to prevent this from happening in the future. FEMA, the review of Hurricane Rita funds has been closed. Because of the storm's destruction to the agency's facilities and property, FEMA allowed $4.5 million in cost recovery for 15 TPWD projects involving emergency protective measures, initial recovery, and capital construction. KPMG closed their audit of the agency's state expenditures of federal awards. This audit resulted in no significant findings. However, it was noted during KPMG's audit that our grant expenditures didn't reconcile between our accounting system, BIS, and our state accounting system, USAS. The unreconciled amount was about $300,000, which KPMG did not feel it was significant or material. However, the state auditor's office used this finding in their audit report of the financial portion of the statewide single audit, and there will be a follow-up audit performed in the next few months by SAO. The grant section has improved its reconciliation method and can now balance between biz and USAS. Gartner completed its IT security assessment. Because of the sensitive nature of the IT security, the report and its contents are confidential. However, from what I understand, Gartner's assessment of the 60 to 70 state agencies resulted in a recommendation to the Department of Information Resources stating that more money and employees are needed for the state, these state agencies to increase their IT security environment. I'm not sure at this point what impact this will have for our agency at this time, but I will keep you updated as I get more information. Comptroller conducted an on-site audit of our many things: payroll, purchases, travel, employee relocation, housing rental expense, revenue refunds, utilities, payment cards, and grant transactions. After reviewing the draft report, all in all, I feel the agency fared very well, especially compared to the past years. Our agency is preparing responses to the Comptroller audit as we speak, and the report will be issued very soon. Experius. This is an ongoing audit, and as of the last update, they've reviewed over 350,000 payments totaling over $200 million, and they found about $31,000 in overpayments. This was due to a contract rate change reduction that did not take place when it was supposed to. However, this has been corrected, and the contractor has given us credit for the overcharge. FEMA contacted us a couple of weeks ago, and they're going to do a port security grant audit. This review has just begun, and documentation has been gathered.
On that point, on the FEMA audit for the port security deals, that covers every port, like from Port of Orange all the way to Port of Brownsville, right? Is that?
This grant was used by law enforcement to purchase some boats, I believe. So they'll be auditing those purchases. There were very few transactions.
Wasn't that much. I know a lot of FEMA money went to all the ports. I'm very familiar with them, and so I was just curious. What does make up this particular deal that's under our jurisdiction that you have to be audited for? So I'd just be curious to see the numbers and see exactly what that was for.
It's I'll get that. From what I remember, it's right around $600,000, and they used it to, the law enforcement division used it for purchasing boats.
Yeah, those are pretty expensive boats. Anyway, I just, and which ports that went to.
I'll give you that information. I'll make a note before I forget.
That's what I have to do. Write it down right now. It's history.
Okay. I'd like to briefly highlight the development timeline of the fiscal year internal audit plan for 14. Starting next month, after the year end close, I'll begin gathering agency information. Part of that information involves a strategic plan, land or water plan, financial budget data, third-party contractor information, IT system information, we'll look at prior audits, FTEs, any number of things. This information is reviewed, and we put together a divisional workbook, and it's sent to our executive team and division directors for their review. This year, we'd like to go and down a little deeper into the agency and send it to our managers and program areas, because we do have this information by org code. Internal audit will then start scheduling and conducting interviews, in which the interviews responses have been captured. We will compile the risk identified during the interview process. I'll ask for the commission's input, and once the information has been consolidated, I'll prepare a final draft of the proposed audit projects for fiscal year 14. At the commission meeting in November, I'll present the final list of projects for you and your approval. This concludes my update. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions or comments? I want to go back to the was discrepancy noted between grants, as I remember.
Mm-hmm. Between BIS and USAS.
What do those acronyms stand for?
BIS is a business information system, and it's our internal accounting system. And USAS is a uniform statewide accounting system. And it's the state, the comptrollers, it's the comptrollers, it's the state. It's the official accounting system.
I guess the other question is, I guess I understand that the comptroller historically had a significant audit capability. And I thought the audits, external audits, were generally conducted by the SAO. Is this unusual for the comptroller?
No, the comptroller, about every 2 to 4 years, they'll come in and do a post-payment audit.
That office has an audit team?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anybody have any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Give me just a second. Let's skip ahead on the agenda. I think it's item 6, to Brandy Reeder's presentation, if that's okay with everybody. Let's commercially protected finfish reporting requirements, mandatory electronic reporting. Brandy Reeder, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My boss left, Mr. Smith. My name is Brandy Reeder. I'm the Fisheries Law Administrator for the Law Enforcement Division. I'm here today to request amendment to Proclamation 57.372, Reporting Requirements. Currently, finfish import license holders must submit a copy of each shipment invoice related to commercially protected finfish to the TPWD regional law enforcement offices by the 10th of each month following the month of shipment via fax or overland mail. The requested changes to Proclamation 57.372, Packaging Requirements, would require mandatory electronic reporting of each imported, exported, or interstate shipment of commercially protected finfish to the department within 24 hours via department-approved Internet application. This rule change will increase efficiency for LE and license holders alike. It will ensure data is readily available to staff, reduce reporting errors, as well as provide a tool to ensure compliance. A web-based commercial protected finfish database has been developed by the department and tested by a subset of industry who approve this system and appreciate the streamlined reporting process. As of yet, public comment has shown only three respondees, and three were in favor of the changes. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have on this item.
Any questions or comments? You say mandatory electronic reporting within 24 hours. That would be within 24 hours of
the shipment. What the deal is that the system is actually set up to where they create their invoices within the system, and that is the reporting. So it's providing a window. The 24 hours was supplied as a window to where if the system for some reason goes offline, or whatever may happen, that they could then send an email until things are squared away. So it's just providing a backup plan, but ordinarily they would report directly into this system, so there would really be no delay.
But if it's a proposed rule change, it would require the report to be submitted within 24 hours of the shipment, not the issuance of an invoice.
Correct.
All right. Is any other comments, questions? And if there's no further discussion, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action by the Commission. Thank you, Brandy.
Thank you.
I guess let's move to, unless we want to take a short recess, let's move. Anybody need a recess? Let's go to item 5, briefing on the prohibition of the use of noxious or toxic substances to capture non-game wildlife death, which is going to be John Davis. John, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is John Davis. I'm the Program Director for the Wildlife Diversity Program in the Wildlife Division. And I'm here to brief you this morning on a petition that we received back in March of this year related to a particular means of take for non-game wildlife. That means of take includes introducing a noxious substance into animal retreats, such as burrows or karst features like caves, crevices, or sinkholes, and it's commonly referred to as gassing. To address this issue, I'm going to do a couple of things today. I'm going to talk a little bit about some background. I'm going to go through some growing concerns related to this means of take, and then kind of provide you a current status update on the conversation with our stakeholders at this time. As best we can tell, this practice began in Texas in about 1940. And originally, many substances were tried, kerosene, alcohol, oil, even ammonia. But by the 1950s, gasoline was considered to be the most popular substance. And this particular means of take is associated most commonly with a commercial collection of western diamondback rattlesnakes in Texas. In other states, it's been other species, but in Texas, predominantly the western diamondback rattlesnake. If you look at how this lays on the landscape, the green area there is the distribution of the western diamondback rattlesnake in the state. The red are the counties where we have known commercial collection of this particular species occurring. You can see there's pretty significant overlap. Some growing concerns with this particular means of take. First, it's an indiscriminate means of take, which means not only are the target species impacted, but non-targets are also impacted, and it fouls habitat for other species. And as we look at the impact on other taxonomic groups, I'm going to go through various taxonomic groups and talk about the vulnerability. First of all, reptiles and amphibians have been demonstrated to actually have the most resilience to impacts of gasoline vapor. Speak and Mount in 1973 studied this particular means of take when it's used in gopher tortoise burrows, and they found significantly that less than 50% of the snakes in those burrows when the burrows were gassed left, and of those, with few exceptions, those that didn't leave died. Campbell in 1989 also studied this issue in a laboratory setting and tested many different species of snakes and lizards and toads, and found after 30 minutes of exposure, there was a dramatic and obvious effect, with a range of impacts being significant short-term impairment to death. But as we move up the chain, or the pyramid, if you will, of vulnerability, we get into mammals. It's pretty well documented. Mammals are impacted pretty severely by gasoline vapors. Many studies studying different exposures have found death can occur in a matter of minutes or a matter of hours. Again, moving up the chain of vulnerability, we get to birds. There was a reason why coal miners used canaries down there in the coal mines. Birds are known to have much more efficient lungs than mammals, much more sensitive to chemical contaminants in the air than mammals, and studies have demonstrated this pretty explicitly. But by far, the most vulnerable group of species to this particular means of take would be invertebrates. The pesticide industry has known this for quite some time and has utilized this in creating many different pesticides. And you may be asking yourself, why should we really be concerned about invertebrates in this particular means of take? It's because since 1988, in Texas, there have been 26 species of karst invertebrates that have been listed federally as endangered. And another reason why that's even more important is in 2012, 15 of them had critical habitat designated, which is a part of that process when the feds list a species, they designate critical habitat, and it's a specific meaning. And issues that have arisen from the recent critical habitat designations include specific mention of direct chemical pollutants, specifically mentioning petrochemicals as a threat to these species. As you may know, at TPWD, our goal is to keep wildlife populations healthy, thus hopefully averting the need to list species. And as we look at the five-factor threats analysis that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service conducts as they review a species and determine whether or not that species would be listed, there are a couple of these that are of particular note related to this particular gassing practice. If you look at number one, the present threatened destruction, modification, or curtailment of a species, range, or habitat, as the feds look at this particular practice, it's reasonable to assume that they would consider this to be a factor under number one. Under number four, other natural or man-made factors affecting the continued existence of the species could also apply. And again, looking at how this lays out across the landscape of Texas, these are the counties that contain karst systems in Texas. These are the counties that have caves and crevices and sinkholes and such. It's important to note that these are the systems that contain the 26 federally listed invertebrates, but also important, they contain 130 endemic invertebrate species, which means those invertebrates are found nowhere else but Texas. And these invertebrates are very similar in habit and location to the currently listed invertebrates. And as we begin to overlay the counties with known commercial collection of western diamondback rattlesnakes, we see significant overlap. But it's not just the karst invertebrates that are of a concern. When we overlay just three species that are currently being petitioned for listing or currently under some review, we begin to see that this issue applies to more than just invertebrates. If we go one step further and we begin to overlay some of the species of greatest conservation need in our conservation action plan, species that use karst features or burrows, you can see that it is a statewide concern that moves well beyond invertebrates. So that brings us to the current status. If we go back to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife five-factor threats analysis, and if we look at the very last item on this list, the feds look at existing regulations to determine whether or not they feel a species warrants additional protection. And as you may know, we currently do not have any regulation on this particular means of take. However, we do have similar regulation in our fur-bearer regs where no person may use chemical irritants of any kind to take fur-bearing animals. Likewise, Texas is the only state within the range of the western diamondback rattlesnake, the United States range of the western diamondback rattlesnake, that currently does not restrict or regulate this means of take in any way. And so this issue has been one that has been a conversation between stakeholders and the department for quite some time. We have letters we've received back in the 70s. But with these growing concerns of karst invertebrates and other species of concern, our communication and our conversation with stakeholders has increased in frequency. You can see there on the slide, in January of 2010, we met with the Sweetwater JCs. In October of 2010, we held a stakeholder meeting in Fort Worth with our non-game, many of our non-game dealer collectors and permittees. And then we also met with some elected officials in the Sweetwater area that same year. In 2011, the Wildlife Diversity Advisory Committee requested a briefing on this issue, and so we briefed that committee. And since that time, we've been in correspondence with venom producers and suppliers, as well as general correspondence with stakeholders and other groups. But in October of 2011, we surveyed all commercial non-game dealers and collectors. There are 868 individuals that are permitted for collecting and dealing non-game species in the state of Texas. You see, there were 771 that provided no response. There were 97 that responded. And at the first glance, this might appear to be a little disconcerting with such a large non-response rate. However, if you note that there have only been 81 permittees have bought or sold western diamondback rattlesnakes in the last 3 years. And if you look individually, the average is about 39 individuals that buy or sell rattlesnakes each year. The reality is this particular practice is pretty insignificant to the vast majority of our permit holders. And so that non-response rate seems reasonable. However, of those that did respond, 5 indicated they used gas. 92 indicated they did not use gas. So even among those for which the issue was important enough to respond, the vast majority indicated they did not use gas.
What do they use?
They actually either road collect or they collect under logs or under debris out in the field, et cetera. So it's basically opportunistic collecting.
I was reading an article about a 97-year-old woman collects rattlesnakes and has since she was apparently young. And she used the term smoke them out. Do you know what that means?
Smoke was originally one of the things that was tried. Remember when I said there were a lot of different substances tried? Smoke was one of those things. I don't know that many people are using smoke now. It could also be kind of a colloquial reference to gassing them. I just don't know. I think I read an article about that same lady myself. Yeah. But smoke was definitely one of the things used early on, for sure.
Did it work?
I don't know. I've never been around when smoke was used, so I really couldn't tell you. As you might imagine, we've gotten a lot of correspondence from stakeholders indicating opposition to this particular means of take. A particular note on this list is the Wildlife Diversity Advisory Committee, the Texas chapter of the Wildlife Society, several notable zoos. If you move down that list, you see several venom producers and dealers, as well as vaccine producers. But at the very bottom of the list is what brings us here today, is a petition for rulemaking we received back in March of this year. We had 57 signatures asking us to regulate this means of take. You might also imagine we've received feedback from those who are not opposed to this particular means of take. We have received letters, emails, or statements from 5 non-game dealers, from 1 venom producer, and we've received verbal communication from the Sweetwater JCs, as well as the Lomita Rattlesnake event organizer and 5 participants at our stakeholder meeting in Fort Worth. And as we've discussed this issue in conversation with our stakeholders, there have been several concerns that have been brought up. They're listed here. Several have expressed a feared shortage of venom for one reason or another, whether it's for the production of anti-venin or whether it's for medical research. Our research indicates that that's not the case. We've contacted the major venom producers, and they've told us that they use captive colonies. They don't use wild-caught venom, and so it's not an issue. Some have expressed a fear of being cited for unknowingly possessing gassed snakes. We believe that could easily be taken care of. Should we decide to look at this issue, we believe we could take care of that with phrasing in any proposed rules. The same with fear of impacting legal pest management practices. I think that could be something we address simply with wording. But the last one, fear of impacting rattlesnake events, our research indicates that that's not going to be the case. I can go into the details of that if you would like, but those events are evolving and have evolved, and we've even gotten a letter from the second largest event in the state saying any regulation of this means of take is not going to impact our event. So we just don't believe those fears are founded. Which brings us back to the petition that we received in March. We are seeking your guidance on how to proceed. And just as a reminder, there are 2 options that I see at this time. One is no action at this time, or to give us permission, draft rules, and bring them back to you in November.
Reed, I just have a question.
Yes, sir.
What do other states do? All the other states, except that they just outright ban, or are there exceptions, or what? Law in the other states?
Yes, sir. The question is, what are other states do in relation to this? And it varies. Many of them simply have it banned as de facto. You can't do it. There are only certain allowed means of take that they mention, and if it's not mentioned, then it is outlawed. Others specifically outlaw that. Some states have even said, because of this particular practice and this particular species, it is critical that we outlaw it here, and so they'll delineate an area and outlaw it. So it just depends on the state. I can get you a list if you would like to see that.
I was curious, but I'd like to propose we study this further and some rules discussed next meeting.
Yeah. I agree. You know, I think a small number of stakeholders we're talking about, I think you said 5 and the bike kill. I agree. I think we ought to review the rules and talk about it next meeting.
I agree. Also, what would be the criteria of, if it were to be so-called regulated, what would be the guidelines or the expectations from these individuals? I think, you know, to research this a little bit further, get more what other states are doing is important.
Anybody else have any comments? I think that we would like for the staff to go ahead and draft some proposed rules for consideration by the commission at the November meeting. So let's proceed. I realize there are strong feelings on both sides of this issue, but
there's no harm, at least in considering draft rules, given that we're the only state in the region that doesn't have it. So let's at least have some to consider.
Okay, we'll bring those to you in November.
Okay, thank you, John.
Thank you.
And let me just make sure I'm clear. Are we going to be presented with options of rules, or are we going to be presented a rule and then we get to rip it apart? We're going to be presented with options. I think what we're saying, we want options.
You can rip those apart as well.
Oh, yeah, we will. Stipulated.
I'm glad you recognize that.
Honestly, I'm not sure, but we could do either. I would imagine.
I saw Ann shaking her head. Ann, can you do that? Can you give us like some options? I think what we're wanting to see is, what are some of the other states doing? You know, there's two or three ways to write a rule. You can write it exclusory. You can write it, all-inclusive, whatever. We'd like to look at all of the options.
I'm member at General Counsel, and absolutely we can do that. I mean, what we would be looking, it's my understanding that what the Commission is wanting to see in November is not a rule for adoption, but a rule that may or may not be submitted to the Texas Register as a proposal. As a result, we can easily come back, well, I won't say easily. We can come back to the Commission with options for the Commission to consider, in addition to an option of not doing anything.
Okay. Good point. We want options. And
okay. Thank you. All right. Let's move now to Brandy. Would you please come back up? Let's take possession of undersized oysters. Brandy Reeder.
Who has been spotted at various and sundries local barbecue joints around town.
Absolutely.
Just saying.
It could be research.
It would be that, yes. Good morning again, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. My name is Brandy Reeder, for the record. I am the Fisheries Law Administrator for the Law Enforcement Division. I am requesting non-substantive changes to the oyster fishery rules regarding undersized oysters. Currently, compliance of oyster fishermen is hampered in some instances by an inability of officers to ascertain culled oysters from unculled oysters on board commercial oyster boats. While current rules require culled oysters to be kept separate from unculled oysters, there's not a definition for either of those present in the. Boy, I'm having issues. Hold on. Okay, so there's not a definition currently in the rules for either of those, which is creating an enforcement issue. Okay. Proposed changes to the statewide oyster fishery proclamation include supplying a clear definition for culling oysters and providing a method to assist officers in the identification of unculled oysters. Proposed changes require that unculled oysters may not be placed in a sack. They must always be kept separate from culled oysters and may not exceed the volumetric equivalent of 6 sacks. These changes will provide industry with clarification and supply criteria to enable a more efficient detection of violations. Public comment was light with this item as well, with only 3 respondents again in favor of the changes. And that concludes my presentation, if you have any questions.
I got a question for you. Culled oysters are supposed to be put back into the water, correct? No?
The process of culling is determining a lawful cargo. So what they'll do is they'll bring on board all these oysters. Well, there's a size limit that they must stay within. So they're allowed 15% of their total catch undersized oysters. So they get to kind of muddle through, and so they're allowed to keep oysters that are less than 3 inches within their cargo. So they're culling through to get that kind of close to that percentage. And so then the unculled oysters, whenever they're first bringing them on, that's what they have in possession. They're not allowed to have over 6 sacks of those on board while they're fishing. So once they get to a certain level, they're supposed to be considered culled. What we're having problems with is that there are instances in which fishermen are trying to skirt around, and so they're sacking up unculled, or what they'll consider unculled, oysters. Well, then whenever wardens go to check the requisite 5% of their cargo, the fishermen will either not indicate that these are unculled, or because of language barriers, may be unable to specifically articulate that these are considered uncoaled. These proposed changes will provide a definite method by which they have to be kept separate. They can't be sacked. So usually whenever an officer goes on board, they will check sacked oysters first, or you know, that's our usual process. They'll pull a sack of oysters out and check that sack. So by prescribing a method by which they are not allowed to sack up unculled oysters, which we're not supposed to check anyway, so if they're kept separate with these new proposals, then that will assist us to make sure that we're not checking those unculled, which would be a problem in court later.
So basically, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but so basically when they bring the oysters on board, they don't put them in a sack until they've culled them.
Correct. That's how normal industry operates. However, a few folks have gotten a little smart, and so then they're...
They said, no, those aren't culled. We were going to cull those later.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
I would just say, as you draft this, let's try to make clear that once they've culled them, the smaller ones get put back in the water.
That's already provided under one of the subsections, I think it's B, is that they're required to return, or their cargo can only be comprised of 15% undersized, and the rest must be returned to the reef.
Anybody have any other questions, comments?
Really, what you're clarifying is sacking.
Correct. Is distinguishing how uncold oysters may not be sacked, and about how they're supposed to be kept separate at all times.
There's no further discussion. We'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you.
Ken Kurzowski, would you come present exotic species rule amendments regarding draining water from vessels and portable containers and request permission to publish?
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. My name is Ken Kurzowski, Inland Fisheries Division. I'm here today to go over some proposed changes to the rules on draining water that are a result of some recent bill passed in the recent legislative session. HB 1241 was passed that gives the Commission additional rulemaking authority. The additional authority allows us to directly require now persons leaving or approaching public water to drain water from their vessels, and that results from them being on those public waters. And pursuant to the passage of those rules, the bill further stated that our wardens would have the specific authority to inspect the vessels for these actions. Bill also stated that and none of these rules or the rulemaking would apply to any salt water of the state. While we are certainly pursuing a lot of actions to combat various exotic aquatic species, these rules particularly target zebra mussels. As we've relayed to you before, the zebra mussels have a free-swimming microscopic stage called a veliger that will be present in the water. It can occur in any water taken up from the infected waters. You can't see it with the naked eye, and it's easily transported in any of the containers, live wells that are on most of the boats and vessels that are on our public waters. We do have some current regulations, as you know, based on our prohibitions against the possession and transport of exotic aquatic species. Those current rules are that boaters and anglers are deemed in compliance with not transporting an exotic aquatic species, zebra mussel specifically, if they drain water from their boats. There are some limitations to that. We need to be able to prove the presence of microscopic veligers in any water on their boats in order to enforce that. And also the other portion of that is we can only apply that currently on waters where we have established that are infested with zebra mussels. Currently we have these rules in place on Texoma and portions of the Red River, Lake Levan, Ray Roberts and Louisville were added after that. And just this summer we added Bridgeport, Eagle Mountain, and Fort Worth by emergency order as zebra mussels were discovered in Bridgeport, so that we have currently have those rules in place on the Red River and a couple forks of the Trinity River. What we're proposing to do to implement these changes is to restructure our Chapter 57, where some of those current rules currently reside. We have one section, a couple sections that concern exotic aquatic species. One is 57.792J, which is restricts the transport of non-game fishes in selected areas. This was implemented a few years ago over the concerns of transport of some of the carp, silver carp, and bighead carp out of some of our waters. And we also have those current rules in 57.792K, and we plan to create a new section and to address the new rules and just move those existing rules as is over to that section. What our proposed changes would do is that we'll directly require persons to drain water from vessels leaving and approaching public water. This will apply to all areas that boats can be launched, public boat ramps, private boat ramps, boat ramps people have on private property, or even improvised boat ramps where people just launch off a bank. Now with some of our lower levels and some of our reservoirs, people are using four-wheel drive to access, try and get in the water. For instance, on Lake Travis right now, we don't have any public boat ramps, so we have to look ahead and make sure we cover all those areas. And once again, it'll cover all those receptacles, live wells, and everything that could have come in contact with public water. We do propose some exceptions to that. We have this first one is currently an exception we have in the current rule, and we do allow people to travel between access sites on the same water body during the same day. We added that. Specifically, as you know, when we started this, it was on Lake Texoma. We have an excellent striped bass fishery on Lake Texoma. We have a very active guiding community up there, and they will frequently start on one end of the reservoir, maybe collect bait or put in, and if the wind changes or they need to go take their clients to a different part of the lake, they'll pick up and they'll move to that in the course of the day. And so in order that they would not have to drain all the water if they had any live bait on or even some striped bass on board, we allow them to do that. And also, for instance, if there's a bass tournament on some of our larger reservoirs, we allow them to take out in one spot and go to another access area further away in without having to drain water if they're hauling bass in water for a live release tournament. We also added some language there to exempt governmental activities. For instance, if TCEQ is out there taking water samples or local communities are going out sampling, doing water testing on the body of water for drinking water, it allows them to go out there and collect those samples. Sometimes those samples are fixed with something that would kill the villagers. Sometimes they're just taken as is and taken back to lab, so we would allow them those activities. And also if there's any sort of emergency situation, bad weather, storms coming in where people have to get off the lake, get out of the area, or some sort of a health accident injury, we would exempt also those activities. Also marine sanitary systems, many of those uptake the sort of non-potable water into the systems, but all the used water for that would be held in a gray water system, and those would be usually offloaded in approved areas. And finally, we would allow persons who commercially purchase live bait, say if you want to go crappie fish and you purchase some minnows, if you had a receipt for that, you could bring those onto the reservoir to use as bait. What this does allow us to do, it allows us to apply to waters currently not infested, which is a big advantage. And what we're envisioning is to try and encompass the current infested waters with sort of a buffer zone. And what we propose to do is to apply that to all the public water bodies in those listed counties rather than just picking out individual water bodies, as there's quite a number of them in these counties. And we're basically, as the next slide will show, we have the DFW area north to Texoma. And the counties that we have proposed to have this rule in a place on are 17 counties up in that area. That the counties are listed sort of left to right, top to bottom there, and you can see the current spots where we have confirmed zebra mussel populations sort of from the northeast to the southwest. That's Texoma, Ray Roberts, Lewisville, and Bridgeport. And there are a number of, quite a few, about 23 major reservoirs included. This is the list of that. So the reservoirs in that area, there's a number of smaller reservoirs, CFLs within cities. Fortunately, a lot of those, not a lot of boat traffic coming off of them. We're not as concerned as those as the major reservoirs where there's a lot of boat traffic going around the DFW area. These rules will impact both our anglers and boaters. They'll have to drain that water before they travel to or from the access areas. Previously, if you went out and caught some fish, left them in your live well and wanted to transport them in that water, you wouldn't be able to do that. You'd have to put them in a cooler on ice. We don't want that water going off the reservoir. It'll affect bait collecting activities. If you want to collect some shad, you can go out there and collect the shad if you're on the reservoir, but you couldn't take those off the reservoir live because you can't have water, and you wouldn't be able to take them and go to another reservoir and use that personally caught bait. It also impact if there's tournaments that you're having an off-site weigh-in, you wouldn't be able to transport live fish from those weigh-ins to an off-site unless that weigh-in site was, as we said, we have that exception if it's right on that same reservoir. Next step, so we were going to use our available resources to publicize these changes. We've been doing the last 3 years. We've had a public awareness campaign up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We have some existing partners up there, water utilities and the other. We want to get this information out to our boaters and anglers. We also plan to go up there and, you know, conduct some public meetings, probably a couple in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, up around Texoma in early October to, you know, just get the word out there and get people's comments on these proposed changes. So with that, we would seek permission to publish these proposed changes as outlined in the Texas Register for Public Comment. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And let me ask you, why do we propose to exempt commercially purchased live bait when we say you can't transport live fish taken from them?
Well, most of the commercial, say if you purchase minnows, most of that, almost and on the freshwater side, the water that they use is just the water from city systems that's been treated. So that water is not water that's taken out of a public water for the live bait. If you have the commercial establishments don't use that type of water to hold their minnows. So.
Yeah, but a lot of people pull water out of an infested reservoir and have a live well there where they've got minnows. To me, that seems inconsistent. I'm not sure we should exempt that.
Well, we could. I don't. Maybe if there's some other language we could use, if the water's taken out of a treated system rather than from a. That's what we're trying to allow people to still use live bait if it's from a water source.
Well, I would encourage us to be specific about that. Number one, number two, I think the definition of what needs to be drained. I didn't see motors, and I was just up in Colorado where they have mandatory inspection of each boat, each vessel, whether it's a sailboat, kayak, no matter what it is, going in and out of every body of water. And they have 800 inspectors throughout the state who are doing this and put a wire, a little metal clamp that shows the boat's been inspected and give them a certificate for it. I mean, they're extremely vigilant. I realize that would probably not be practical in the state with as many water bodies as we have, but I think we ought to be very clear that you got to drain the water or flush the water from the motors, because this guy, one of the agents up there, told me they found a velger inside the motor, and they actually have a machine there with hot water that they inject the hot water into the engine compartment to kill the velger inside the engine. They found them in inside boat wells, not just live wells and that sort of thing. And I also ought to make clear it ought to apply to any boat that comes in and out of it, not just a motor craft. somebody could have a sailboat sitting.
A vessel, the definition vessels applies to everything.
It's not clear whether it's broadened. I'm just
right. Yeah, that's there's a definition in statute that includes all that, and we could specify.
I'm going to share. I brought back the paperwork from Colorado. I want to share with you. I already mentioned it to Gary.
Right.
But I think it's anyway. I think it's great we're doing this, but we want to be as if we're going to do this. Let's give ourselves as much. Discretion there as we can to try to manage this. At least that's, I think we'll look at that and publish it and get comments. Dan Allen.
Ken, you said the bill allows inspection. Is there any type of penalty? Can somebody get a citation if they take water and they're stopped somewhere
yes,
away from the lake?
Yes, it'd be a Class C misdemeanor.
Okay.
That violation.
Vic. For you, is that the deal they're doing in Colorado strictly for that zebra mussel?
Yes.
Same thing.
Yes, they found it in Grand Lake, and so every boat going in or coming out has to have it. That's that one lake where they found it. Now, they've not found the mussel; they just found the
belly. So I assume, Carter, that do our people talk to their people?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. If you heard, though, 800 inspectors and, you know, considerably less water in Colorado. But that's an impressive response, no doubt. But, yeah, Gary and our team and Ken are absolutely talking to our counterparts there in Colorado and other states on this. This is a national problem. Everybody is contending with the spread of these aquatic exotics. And so really looking at, you know, how we can learn from other practices in other states and vice versa.
Yep. Dr. Earl Chilton of our staff was just out a meeting in Denver. To go over and get some information from them. So he's our liaison.
Because we ought to look and see how they're doing, even though they're different. Our states are different.
Yep.
But,
right.
And we obviously don't at this point have those kinds of resources. But anyway, let's my suggestion, let's draft this is to give the department as much enforcement discretion as we can do.
That's our goal, certainly. So.
Anybody else have any comments or questions? All right, let's see. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes with the adjustments we just talked about in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Let's go now to item 9, use of dogs to trail wounded deer. Recommended adoptions proposed changes, which will be made by Scott Baca. Welcome, Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. I'm here this morning to present proposed changes to the regulations concerning the use of dogs to trail wounded deer. First, I'm going to go over some background on this particular rule, these regulations. In 1990, the department adopted regulations prohibiting the use of dogs to trail wounded deer in 34 counties. In 2001, the department removed this prohibition in 10 counties where the practice of hunting deer with dogs had become virtually non-existent. In 2005, the Texas legislature passed House Bill 1959, which added Parks and Wildlife Code Section 62.0065. This statute stipulates that a person may not recklessly use a dog to hunt or pursue a deer in this state. This statute also authorized the commission to prescribe the type of firearm that may be possessed during an open deer season by a person who is in possession of a dog while in the field on another person's property in 22 counties. In addition to implementing the provisions of House Bill 1959, the department removed the prohibition on the use of dogs to trail wounded deer in two additional counties. And with that rulemaking, that brings us to our current regulations. It is lawful to use not more than two dogs to trail a wounded deer in all Texas counties except the 22 East Texas counties highlighted on this slide. In addition, it is unlawful to be on another person's property while in possession of a shotgun and buckshot or slugs in these East Texas counties. Lastly, it is unlawful to use dogs to hunt, pursue, or trail deer in all Texas counties. The proposed changes would remove the prohibition on using dogs to trail wounded deer in 12 East Texas counties. The prohibition would remain in effect in the 10 East Texas counties highlighted on this slide. In addition, the prohibition on possessing a shotgun and buckshot or slugs would remain in effect in the counties depicted on this slide. There's been quite a bit of public comment on this proposal. This shows that 352 have commented in support and 625 in opposition. And looking at some of at the reasons for opposition, the vast majority do not understand the regulations proposal. And this is broken out. The number one is animal welfare concerns. And reading what they were actually saying, there was a lot of comments concerning cruelty to the deer and abusive of the deer, not really realizing that we're discussing trailing a deer that's already been wounded using lawful means. So those were broken out from others that just didn't understand the proposal, including some that thought it was just setting dogs loose to go trail a deer for a hunter to go to find, basically hunting deer with dogs. Others specifically mentioned hunting deer with dogs, or this would enable that. Some opposed it, or actually they entered their comments in opposition, but in reality they were in favor of it. They just wanted additional counties either included or excluded. And some were in favor of it with provisions for GPS or other types of dog collaring. As you can see, there's some other specific reasons broken out that were given.
What were the animal welfare concerns?
Cruelty to the deer was basically the number one term used.
Actually, reverse is true.
If you looking through the comments, it appears there may have been some concerted effort by some groups in the Dallas-Fort Worth area to comment on this proposal.
And find standardized language.
A lot of common phrases and a lot out of Tarrant County.
Commissioner, just I want to add something if I could, just for y'all to think about. When we were doing public hearings over in East Texas and meeting with various individuals that had an interest in all of this, there was some stated concern by a number of landowners that somehow the department would be contemplating opening back up being allowed to hunt deer with dogs. And we were unequivocal and emphatic that that was not something that the commission was contemplating on that. But there was a concern that was registered that somehow this was proverbial nose under the tin. And I just want to let you know what we have told folks, that that is not anything that this department or the commission is considering in any way, shape, or form. It's not been on anybody's conversation, nothing. So just want to make sure that y'all heard that from me.
Right. If I could add to that, there was public meetings held in Hemp Hill, Lufkin, and Woodville. A total of 41 people attended at those three meetings. Between the three of them, 10 spoke in support of the proposal and 3 spoke in opposition. And that concludes my presentation for today, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any other questions or comments? Hey, Scott, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, sorry, Jim, go ahead.
One question. Can you just, for background, give me a little more detail on how a hunter would have dogs ready, up to 2 dogs ready, to chase a wounded deer, but not be out hunting a deer with dogs? They go back and pick up the dog? I mean, how does it practically happen?
There are actually people that have a business. That's their. You get a call and they come out to wherever you're at, and they have dogs that have been trained to go to the last known point, pick up a blood trail, and go to a, you know, whether it's wounded or expired.
The places where I've seen them where they had the dogs on site, the dogs are kept in a kennel. If the hunter loses a deer or can't find the deer, then they come back and get the dogs, take them back to the last spot of known activity or whatnot, and put the dogs on the trail.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. We'll place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 10, let's go to item 12, land acquisition. Welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Morning, everyone. Thanks, Ralph. Appreciate it. Number 11, Hunter Education Course Requirements, recommended adoption of proposed changes. Morning.
How's it going, Dan? Morning, Commissioners. I'm Nancy Heron. I'm the Outreach and Education Director, and I have with me this morning Robert Ramirez, our Hunter Education Manager. We'll do a little tag team presentation for you this morning. We're here to discuss adoption of changes to Hunter Education that were posted in the Texas Register. Hunter Education, the course itself, covers Hunter Education basic firearm safety, wildlife laws, hunting laws, and the wildlife management that drives those laws, as well as responsible action in the field while hunting. I'm going to show you a quick graph here that shows the effectiveness of hunter education. The number of students trained and certified in hunter education is in blue and has increased over the years, with a record number of 45,000 in 2012. In orange, you see the corresponding decline in hunter accidents. So we're now down to less than 3 per 100,000 hunters. Hunter education works. It's a great program, and we hope more people will take hunter education. It is in that spirit that these proposed changes are being put forward. They're hoping that more people will take hunter education by offering options that are increasingly flexible and convenient. We approach this expansion with a lot of thought and with conversation and with testing. We convened a task force of staff, volunteers, and partners. We also held 7 open-line noontime conference call conversations with dozens of instructors and one special just for game wardens who are also often hunter education instructors. Staff and some of our best volunteers conducted 16 pilots to look at the course concepts and teaching the course and how much time it would take to teach to a course that focused just on the basics. We wanted to come to you this morning with good information on which to base your decision. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Robert to tell you a little bit more about the course changes and the pilots.
Good morning, Commissioners. Robert Ramirez, Hunter Education Manager. Currently, we have a 2-day class course of 10 hours with a passing score of 70 points, which is $15. Another option is the combination course in which the student can access online home study materials and attend a field day with a passing score of 15 points, which is $15. The home study material is available free on our website, as well as the IHEA website, the International Hunter Ed Association, and it's in English and Spanish. And that content, that study material, is free. There are some vendors that provide additional curriculum and interaction with the student. The student can access that with a fee. We offer a one-time deferral for those who are wanting to try hunting and that are going to be accompanied by a licensed hunter and certified in hunter education, and that fee is $15. The proposed changes are to a 1-day classroom course with a maximum of 5 hours. The combination of the home study, online instruction, and field exercise, no less than 4 hours and no more than 5 hours in duration for the live fire and skills portion of that. And then to recognize an online instruction only for individuals 16 years of age and older. And to consolidate the score for all the options to 75%. wanted to bring attention to you to the fee structure. In our last meeting in May, we had to look at the language that would provide an online provider to set their fee for the online instruction with certification, and this clarifies some of that language to allow that online provider to set that fee. As Nancy mentioned previous, we've done a lot of work. What we've done is we wanted to evaluate that core curriculum to see if it fit into the best guess of the 5 hours for that basic curriculum. Those 16 pilot courses were conducted statewide. We had 324 students in the age range from 9 to 59. And that average time to conduct that core curriculum was 5.6 hours.
We took public comment. We received 113 comments on the proposed changes. We had 39 who were in agreement with proposed changes and 74 who disagreed. The character of those who were in agreement were the appreciation of having a one-day course, the convenience of the options that were being proposed, and a good use of technology. Those who disagreed were primarily citing safety concerns as to whether the student would be achieving the a lifelong certification, that they would retain those concepts to keep them safe out in the field, and were concerned about an increase in hunting-related accidents. The majority of folks were concerned about online instruction, 47, with concerns about verifying who was taking the course. 17 of those said that, and that the minimum age should be a little higher, and that was about 4 respondents. The other main concern was the amount of time that was being proposed. 37 were concerned about that it was not enough time to teach the basic core curriculum and recommended something more in the 6 to 8 hour range. There were 2 concerns about lowering the score, the passing score, and 2 concerns about online vendors being able to set their own fees. With that, we would ask the Commission to consider the recommendation on the hour cap to the course based on the pilots and the comments from our instructors that we make that a little longer, perhaps 5.5 hours. That was the finding, with at least 5.6 was the average amount of time for some of our better instructors to teach the basic concepts. So we would ask some consideration for a change in that 5-hour cap that was proposed in the Texas Register. And then tomorrow we would ask for passage adoption of these proposed changes with whatever modifications you might have.
Chairman, if I could, and I'm sorry, Nancy and I haven't had a chance to talk, but I guess what I would ask, and maybe y'all have some discussion about this, I know that we have recommended going from the 5 to up to 5.5 hours based on the pilot test that we have seen and feedback, thinking about class sizes, which are very variable on these hunter ed classes. You may get some very large ones, some very small ones. You also get folks with a fair amount of different learning variability. Another potential option might be to give us a little bit more flexibility to be able to have the classroom instruction not to exceed 6 hours. And so I'd throw that out there as just might give us a little bit more instructional time there and flexibility inside the classroom for you to think about.
Commissioner Scott.
Yes, and that sounds like a good plan, Carter. I think everybody knows my feelings about having sat through one of these classes before. Did by accident, when you're getting these the people, the naysayers against it, did y'all, document how many were actually people that teach it that make a living from giving that class?
Yes. Now, they don't make a living giving the class, but I would clarify that. But
they get paid, let's put it that way.
They can, retain some dollars to cover the costs. However, it was about 60-40. 60% of the respondents who were against it were instructors, and about 40% were not.
I would
a suggestion. I noticed that you didn't have a cap on the fee that could be charged for the online course. I think we probably should. My thought is we ought to have some cap on that fee. We don't want a provider to price it at a level that becomes too big a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we have the online option, which my understanding that a number of other states have it and are in the trend is to go to youth learn online, whether we do or don't, they do. And as long as we have that option, then I think Carter's suggestion to get instructors in appropriate circumstances the discretion to go to 6 hours if it's required. But we sure ought to encourage instructors to be as efficient as possible here and know that people, this is a big time commitment to give up 6 hours of classroom instruction, not including registration and testing. So.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate it. I agree with that. I agree with, you know, talking about some type of cap for it. But what is currently envisioned in terms of provider for this? Is it providers or
for the online courses? There are several. We have three right now, and the fee ranges from $14 to $25, and then there would be an additional $5 that would come to the state. So it would basically be $20 to $30 for the convenience fee for that online course. And that's what's available now. Any provider that we have needs to be approved by the state, so if you were to set a cap, then that would be one of those criteria under which we would say you can be an approved online vendor or not.
Is it desirable to have three providers, or what?
It does give folks options. It's kind of market-based. We do see a spread. I don't think that one is 14, 15 and the other $14 and the other one is 24 or 25. Hasn't seemed to affect the participation for those vendors.
So at this point, we envision having the same providers create a solution that's the new online solution.
Yes, and to implement this coming year, that would be what we'd have in place.
Okay, any more? Was there some discussion about a cap and how we might be able to implement that?
We had not discussed that, but would certainly be happy to,
any,
to do that.
Any other thoughts on that from anyone on the commission?
I think that would be something to consider, along with, you know, having the option of going not to exceed the 6 hours, but being able to incorporate that what was deemed 5.6 hours. You know, you certainly want, we have a great program in place, and it can be implemented with less time and still have the security and safety issues just half hour. You know, if it's going to fit that criteria, I think that would be something, again, to consider.
The half hour.
And the cap, too. I think that that's important, too, just to keep consistency within this particular organization.
Absolutely.
I think for what it's worth, when we were looking into this, the original NRA Hunter Safety Course, when this all first started going, was 2 hours. I'm confident that Nancy and Robert and others have done a lot of study and work on this and done their best to try to make sure that the essential core elements that need to be covered from a safety and ethics perspective are going to be covered here. Well, I support it.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
please.
I have a couple of questions. Number one, do you have an idea of the percentage of students that have come through the internet course versus the one that's done not online, I guess?
Well, at this point, they can't get certified through home study, through the online course. What we do know is about 40% of our students take it at school. So they get a more extensive course, and that option will still be available. And then the percentage of home study, Robert, do you know?
Not right offhand. We can get that to you. The vast majority that do not get it while at school still choose the traditional option of a two-day, 10-hour course.
And so with the home study and field day, that is an option that they choose, but still the majority is that two-day traditional course.
And the majority being more or less about what percentage?
I would put it around 35% that actually use the online home study.
One thing that was interesting as we were doing some of our research is the state of Indiana, who's had an online course since, I think, 2006. And they have a much smaller pool, but 15,000 or so students and 13,000, 12,000, something like that, still take it in person after all these years. So it's an interesting thing. I think people do, there are a lot of folks who do opt. They want their student, their child to be in a class where they're getting hands-on instruction, working with and getting the mentoring that you get with an in-person course. So it seems to still survive that.
The second question I have is, do you have, of those accidents that have been reported, is there any difference between the students that took the course online, or have you noticed, has there been any monitoring of that?
We do monitor whether they've taken passed Hunter education or not. And so the number of accidents we have are in the 20s to 30s over the last, say, five or six years. The number of people who've been the cause of those accidents that have been a graduate of Hunter education is in the single digits. It varies over the years, but it's just a small percentage of those who caused the accidents. We don't have data on whether they took what we now have in place, the home study, you know, where you do homework online and then come in for the four-hour skills course. And actually, when we looked at this primary course, we were just building a little bit onto the field course. But that combination, we've not seen anything and have not discriminated that. What we will be able to do in the future, however, is tell if those who have caused those accidents are a Hunter education graduate and whether they were in a regular course or an online graduate. We'll be able to track that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I've got one question. I just want to make sure.
Mr. Morin.
The curriculum, has it been adjusted to put it to condensed?
That's correct. What we did is we looked at the course that we have now, which is very comprehensive, and there were 112 objectives that were part of that, and it included things on wilderness survival, you know, out in the field, different types of firearms, more in a little bit about muzzle loading, more about archery and bow hunting. So what we did is we looked at what are the basic core pieces that would keep someone safe in the outdoors while hunting. And so we looked at the International Hunter Education Association standards that would help us maintain reciprocity. Someone had asked earlier about, you know, our hunter education being accepted in other states. So what are those specific pieces that we needed? What by code and by law we are supposed to teach in terms of basic firearm safety, ethics, a little bit about laws. And so we pared it down from 112 objectives to 35 that we felt were absolutely critical to understanding basic hunting practice, safety, firearm safety, wildlife laws. So it is condensed.
And that's the average in your pilot program that was 5.6 hours?
That's correct. That was 5.6 hours. Because it does include some hands-on learning. It's not lecture style, and we do that for just in terms of best practices in education for a lifetime certification. A lecture style is probably not going to be retained as well.
Well, my only comment is if the average is 5.6 with the curriculum you're going to use, it's kind of hard for me to sit here and vote for a 5.5 hour course, but.
Sorry, Reed, could you repeat that?
I'm just saying I'm for 6 hours, allowing them up to 6 hours, because if your average is 5.6, somebody took longer than that. I second the 6 hour allowance.
So I would suggest that we go ahead and amend the proposed change to 2A to classroom instruction not to exceed 6 hours.
Okay.
And also, Anne, can you kind of speak to a possible construct for dealing with the fee structure.
Just use my chair. Go ahead.
I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Yeah, actually, we could make a pretty easy change if you want. What we say is the online instruction providers. Wrong page. Okay, we say that the fee for Hunter Ed delivered by an approved online instructor instruction provider shall be established by the online instruction provider. We could just add, comma, not to exceed an amount established by the executive director. That way we get a little bit of flexibility, and we also ensure that the online providers don't automatically go to the max.
Okay, I'd suggest, thanks, Ann. I'd suggest we incorporate that language. Any other observations?
Is there a way we can, or I, can go to or see, and I think Carter and I talked about this just briefly, a template of what it looks like online. I understand each online provider may do their own cartoons or whatever it is that they may, illustrations, whatnot, but I would just like to see something that somebody has in mind of what the online course would look like.
Absolutely, and we can make arrangements for you to cruise through the three online vendors that exist now. We also have the two free courses that are used as the homework, and we may in the future, if you would like, be one of the providers. But, yeah, we can make arrangements for that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Bill, we're going to time you on that one.
I won't ask for a score.
I'll just tell you what.
Could be embarrassing.
We won't request scores or anything like that.
Need a little remedial work there.
Yeah. Any other questions?
I've got one question. It just really is a question. If we're limiting the course, the instructor to $15 for the course, but let's say we set the online provider at $25, why don't we let the instructor charge the same amount? I know we want to incentivize people to go $15, go to a class, but then you've got an instructor that's putting a lot of his time into it. Supposedly, a little more money, he could have better materials. And it seemed like I know we want to make it as economic as possible, but is it fair to say, okay, let's say 25 is the number online. Why don't we say, well, if you go to instructor class, he can charge up to 25 also? Is there a reasoning there, Carter? Or?
Nancy, is it set in statute?
It is. It is. The $15 for the volunteer-led course is in statute. So that would be something need to come before the legislature.
Okay, that would be something to look at for the future. I think that's a good observation. Good point. Any other questions for Nancy and Robert?
A comment. I did it 8 years ago, and it cost me $75, so somebody really did well. And it took me 18 hours of my life. Boy, that ain't right, huh? Wow. That just ain't right. God almighty.
That was, man. When you have to do it twice, that's what happens.
They must have seen me coming.
Did you have to repeat it?
I guess I did.
All right, great. Appreciate all your hard work on this. I know there's been a lot of work, and it's been very involved. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for consideration.
Thank you. All right, no further discussion. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 12 is land acquisition. Gonzales County, approximately 11 acres as an addition to Palmetto State Park.
Trouble. Yeah, I figured that out.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Smith. My name is Lana Marbach. I'm with the Land Conservation Program, and I'm here to present an 11-acre acquisition at Palmetto State Park. The park is conveniently located within about an hour's drive south of Austin and east of San Antonio. The subject tract is outlined in red in there. Currently, it's under contract. It shares 1,100 feet of common boundary with the park. It will also protect the park entrance and the trail system. And the park superintendent is excited about the opportunity for some primitive camping there. What's particularly exciting about this acquisition is that it's funded in part by a donation from the Friends Group, This is a great example of where donations that the public make to the park are actually spent right there in the park. They can see that their money is being used locally. Here's a section of the boardwalk trail that this acquisition will protect the integrity and viewshed of. Received no public comment on this. And tomorrow I'll be asking that you authorize the executive director to take all necessary steps to acquire approximately 11 acres in Gonzales County for addition to Palmetto State Park. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
How much of the funding is coming from the Friends, and how much is coming from...
It's about 45% from the Friends group, and then 55% from land sale proceeds, state funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks.
Just curious, how long is that boardwalk?
The boardwalk trails, they've got about 6 miles of trails total. I'd say probably 25% of those are actually boardwalks. In the last probably 3 years, the park has enhanced those systems. It's been very popular with guests. And if you see, if you look on the map here, just below the red, you can actually see part of the boardwalk trail, and that's how close it currently gets to the park boundary. So there's a fence line right there. And we want to protect all of that up to the road.
Commissioner, it's worth going to see. This is an old Civilian Conservation Corps park there, and right on the river, part of the old Ateen Swamp. Those little palmettos there are just phenomenal. That boardwalk is really extraordinary. And rumor has it that there's a barbecue joint near there that Brandy also likes. So you might check that out on your way there.
Do we have further research to do?
I think we do. I think so. Road trip.
Road trip.
Looks pretty cool.
Looks terrific.
It's beautiful. It looks beautiful. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So no further discussion. We'll place this item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 13 has been withdrawn. Is that right? And item 14, request for easement, Orange County Crude Oil Transmission Line. Yeah, Ted Hollingsworth, how are you?
Yeah. Never seen Chairman, Commissioners, good morning. For the record, my name is Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. This item is being brought to you in response to a request for an easement for a 36-inch diameter crude oil transmission line. The line will originate in Louisiana and bring product into southeast Texas. The proposal is to cross the extreme northern end of the lower Neches Wildlife Management Area Adams Unit there in Jefferson County. Again, it is a 36-inch, and it's a large line. Right now, the proposal is to directionally drill under the wildlife management area with a single bore pit located in the wildlife management area. Staff is still evaluating the proposal. There is a pipeline corridor immediately north of the wildlife management area. Shell insists that it's already full, that it's already crowded, and that they need to go a different route for safety reasons. Staff is still evaluating that claim. But in the interest of expediency, we were requested to bring this to you in August with possible action to be taken in November. It'd be about half a mile of that line that would cross the wildlife management area. And again, we're also working with Shell to determine if more of that line can't be directionally drilled under the wildlife management area. We have, in other locations, drilled more than half a mile. And we're still exploring whether it would be possible to drill entirely under the wildlife management area so that there's no surface disturbance in the wildlife management area. We're also looking at compensatory mitigation options up to and including the acquisition of land to be added to one of our southeast Texas wildlife management areas. What we're doing this morning is requesting permission to begin the public notice and input process, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Ted? Commissioner Scott.
Well, you said in the interest of expediency, what is your timeline for getting something approved or getting something back to Shell?
I don't have a timeline. They need to demonstrate that there's not a reasonable and prudent alternative. They need to demonstrate that all Possible measures have been taken to avoid impacts to the wildlife management area, and I know they'd like for the commission to take action in November. If we don't have enough information to bring this back in November and assert that we feel like all reasonable actions have been taken to avoid those impacts, we may not come back till January.
But you are getting that point to them that if they'll get you the information, y'all will bring it to us in November.
Staff, we pride ourselves on being responsive to applicants, and so we do make a concerted effort to evaluate those proposals expeditiously and determine whether or not they should be brought to the commission and to bring them to the commission in a timely fashion.
I'm familiar with this line and know what it's for and everything, and so I would just ask that we do that and try to. I know they don't need any help, but perhaps they need a little understanding that if they don't hurry, then we can't either.
I think our staff is very good at communicating to our applicants what is required before the commission can be reasonably expected to take action.
That's right.
Okay, any other questions for Ted on this? Thank you, Ted. Don't go anywhere. Authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Item 15, request for easement, Orange County Gathering Line. Mr. Ted Hollingsworth.
Chairman, commissioners, good morning. For the record, my name is still Ted Hollingsworth. I'm with the Land Conservation Program. And this item is a result of yet another request for an easement across the Adams Bio Unit of the Lower Neches Wildlife Management Area in Jefferson County. This line would cross the southern end of the wildlife management area, Adams Unit. The request is a little unusual for us in that we normally require applicants for gathering lines to actually own or have possess a mineral interest under the property, under our property for a gathering line. In this particular case, the route across the wildlife management area is clearly the expedient route, but more importantly, the wells that are to be drilled into minerals owned by the General Land Office. And so the royalties from that production would go back to the Permanent School Fund. And for that reason, field staff feels like this line can be installed largely by directional drilling with minimal impact to the wildlife management area, and is requesting that the commission consider authorizing that we do go to public notice and input for that gathering line, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Ted on this item? Great. Thank you. I'll authorize staff to begin the public notice and input process. Appreciate it. We'll now hear item number 4 in executive session. Therefore, at this time, I would like to announce that pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551, Government Code referred to as the Open Meetings Act, an executive closed session will be held at this time for the purpose of deliberating personnel matters under Section 551.074 of the Open Meetings Act. We'll now recess for executive session.
Good.
We're now going to reconvene the regular session of the Commission work session, August 21st, 2013, at 2:35. With regard to the executive session item regarding performance evaluation of TPWD Executive Director, no further action is necessary. With regard to executive session item regarding executive director compensation authorized by SB 1 as enacted by the 83rd Texas Legislature, I will place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. This commission has completed its business. I declare the work session adjourned.